Africans at home and throughout the diaspora. Unity is strength. We've got the power.
Now the fussing and the fighting. Now the time to do the right thing.
We need more unity.
Cool. Stop the fussing and the fighting. Now the time to do the right thing.
In the spirit of the Umoja, embrace with love.
Let's do it right now. We've got to do it right. Stop the fussing and
right
the fighting.
Now, right now.
Now the time to do the right thing. Let's do it right now.
Yes, yes, we are going to do it right. This is Jamala Rogers, your host of Voices from the Battlefield, and we are live here at Black Radio Hall of Fame at the historically black campus of Harris Stowe State University. The opinions expressed on Black Radio Hall of Fame are those of the program host and not necessarily those of Harris Stowe or BRHF Radio. So before we get started with our guest in the introduction, I just want to say that we know that across the country there have been pro-Palestinian protests going on, and they have gotten ridiculously out of hand. In particular here in St. Louis, we've seen the overreach and the brutality of police at Washington University. I don't know about St. Louis University yet, but WashU has been front and center. And I'm calling to your attention, Steve Tamara, who was literally a bystander, filming and was, you know, dragged and beaten by police. As you might not know, Sandra Tamara, we had on the show, some months ago. She is a Palestinian. And so, they're very much connected to this struggle. So if you have not been on either one of those campuses or have not been supportive of the Palestinian effort and you want to, seek those campuses out, because the young people are pretty organized. They're now setting up encampments, and vowing to stay until the demands are met. And in the case of WashU, they are demanding that, Boeing, they disinvest from Boeing, because Boeing has been providing much of the military weaponry in that country. So we're wishing them the best. The last time I looked, First Amendment rights were still constitutional, so the young people and anybody that's supporting them are doing that under the protection of the Constitution. So let's keep an eye on that. Let's support them best we can, and let's hope for the best and hope that, you know, Steve Tamara and others who were arrested or were victimized by the police are going to be okay. I've sent something out to Sandra, so if she responds, I will let you know that Steve is okay. So Steve Tamara, brutalized for being a bystander, capturing all of this on tape. I don't even know if he's got the tape anymore, but we'll have more on that later. So we are, this is International Workers' Day. Sometimes it's called May Day. But it is different from Labor Day in that Labor Day is specific to the United States. It's a United States holiday, but both of them uplift worker struggles and, worker issues and worker, solidarity. And so, we have with us somebody who is all about both of those, and that's Steve Pitts. Welcome to the show, Steve.
Hey, Jamala, I'm good to talk with you and glad to be here.
Yeah.
Doing well.
Yeah. So Steve is on the West Coast, but he came to the Labor Center probably in 2001, and before then he was, teaching, Black Studies and Economics. But it was his tenure at the Labor Center, I think, that really, pushed him into what I would call the labor spotlight, and not necessarily around organized labor, but it started to branch out to so many different aspects of workers' struggles. And, you know, this was a center that helped to publish reports on workers' struggles, particularly black workers' struggles. There was a black leadership school. You know, I think you were part of starting Black Workers' Center. So it is a lot that was in that container just based on your leadership. I will also say that once I won't use the word retire, but once Steve left his position at the Labor Center, he came to create and host what's called Black Work Talk. And the thing that I want to say about that, Steve, is because this is the first time I think I've said something like this, but when I talk about myself and Bianca Cunningham taking over your role in Black Work Talk, I said, think about it. It took two women to fill those shoes. So I don't, usually it's the other way around. You know, it takes two men to fill one woman's shoes, but in this case, it definitely took two of us to really put on those shoes and really try to continue the journey that you had started us on. So thank you for all you've done and what you will continue to do. So did I leave anything out?
Well, yeah, a whole bunch, but
you know, I know. I know. We're going to try to talk about that because for me.
So, Jamala, thanks for the kind of the lead in the intro and the compliments. And I proudly grabbed at the title of the old retiree, by the way. And I think a better way to look at the idea of the transition from, you know, me being a host of Black Work Talk and you and Bianca being co-hosts is that I was retired. I had time. And so it took a retired man to take care of what the two working women could do. And that's a better way to look at it, actually.
Yeah, thank you for that clarification. But I remember when it first got floated to me that I was going to be asked to host that. At first I said, okay, following Steve Pitts, that's going to be, a challenge in and of itself. But I said, if I was to really consider it, the only way I'm going to do that if I co-host with a younger person. And they had already thought about that. So myself and Bianca or, you know, intergenerational folks coming at this, you know, coming at these issues from very, very different points, but, you know, still with the notion that we keeping black workers at the center. So it's been fun. And we're going to do a second, you know, season if that's what it's called. So we're planning that now. So thank you for the role that you paid for us and, you know, being able to highlight all the worker struggles across the country has really been enlightening. Even though I keep up with it, but having the folks come on the show and actually talk about it has really, really been enlightening. So thank you for that.
The show, the podcast, both the times I was leading up, the times you and Bianca leading up, is super important because I think that too often when we talk about black folks' issues, we forget the idea of black workers.
Mm-hmm.
And we forget the there's an implicit issue of class and political economy that comes to the surface when we discuss black workers in particular. So I think it's an important voice to be put out there to shed more light on what's happening to our people. So I'm glad that you're able to take up the things and roll with it. I'm really happy that's going on.
And to your point, which is an excellent one, Steve, I think some of that is coming, being amplified with the Black Workers Centers, as well as the fact that there's now Black Labor Day. And so I think lifting up those struggles, we realize that they have been buried. You know, when you even talk about how some of this stuff gets moved, it's been black workers at the center, or at least helping to push. And we often don't get credit for that, but we definitely are the ones that are marginalized on the job. And so I think we have, need to just take our rightful place in the leadership of not just unions, but, you know, worker struggles, period. So I think that's an excellent point. Can you talk about what you think the Black Worker Centers are to the labor movement, but also in highlighting the struggles of black workers? What is their role? Because I know that there were a few that came online, but there were some that were already out there who understood the need for specifically focusing in on black workers. But what does it mean to have a national framework now that's helping to coordinate that work?
Well, I think it's important to get a sense of the fact that starting in the mid to late 90s, there's a rise in development of worker centers in general. And that was largely in the context of the decline of the union movement and also the radical shift in kind of demographics because of increased immigration and shift in our economy and more of a global sort of thing. And so while you did have several black worker centers prior to the early 90s, the kind of a pickup occurred in the 90s for those reasons. And the question was always in that kind of increase in the number of worker centers with black folks. Because the idea is that workers need to be organized. Which means black workers need to be organized. And for a variety of reasons, we can get into more detail if we want to, there's a gap in that. And so what black worker centers are trying to do is fill in the gap. And that means with a couple of things. On one hand, it means to look at where black workers actually are in terms of the workplace and also in terms of working class community issues and how can we support the organizing around those issues themselves. And the second important thing, how do you strengthen the revitalization of organized labor and increase the quantity and quality of organizing taking place inside the labor movement itself? And black workers can play an important role both in helping to make sure that black workers' voices are heard and build power to be part of the process, and also to make sure that when we talk about links between the labor movement and the community, that people see that labor is an important partner in really achieving an increase in the quality of life of black folks.
And I think when we talk about who's not there and who's not at the table, you're right, oftentimes black workers are there, and I think there's a, you know, idyllic conception that, you know, black workers are in these unions wielding lots of power in decision-making positions. And that's not necessarily the case. We're getting better at that. But I think, you know, organizing black workers to really see their power and then how to flex their muscles in spaces where they need to, I think that's really been a key part of the Black Workers Network. And I've had Tanya Wallace Coburn on this show of Voices from the Battlefield, but we also talked to her on the Workers podcast. And so I think, you know, when we start to look at how we organize and how we organize in the 21st century, it's really going to be black workers that are going to lead the way. And so then I start to think about where the centers are, the black workers centers are. And I think about, like, for example, the LA one. And you have, like, the person who headed up that worker center now is a senator. I'm talking about Lola Smallwood Cuevas. And she was able to get money to go back to the worker center. So, you know, just seeing that kind of transition and the understanding that this is a position that she ran for so that she could highlight and uplift black workers in the black community. So, I mean, she brought $2.5 million to the workers center. And, that's what we send our people to Congress or to these elected positions to actually help, you know, strengthen or expand what we're doing on the ground. And she certainly has been an example of that. Any other examples you could think of that the black workers have really tapped into, you know, their power in ways that we probably hadn't seen before?
Well, one thing that we did here in the Bay Area for a while, it was a good campaign and affected then a lot of recent things kind of died down a bit, was trying to work with the question of the formerly incarcerated and how do you get them into good jobs?
Mm-hmm.
Because part of the problem oftentimes is that when people look at the issue of unemployment in general or the plight of the former incarcerated in particular, then oftentimes the mantra is simply get them any old job. And that simply, given the nature of our economy, is simply insufficient, both for the needs of that particular population and the needs of our community in general. And our thought was that, well, the state, the county's case, the state apparatus lock people up, they have obligations to take care of them when they come out. And so we fought for a program that would allow former incarcerated to get county jobs.
Mm-hmm.
That's an example of trying to really restructure how government looks at part of our people,
mm-hmm.
and improve their job outcomes.
Mm,
we won't
okay.
see people in Chicago who are focused on the issue of temp agencies. Mm. As you know, that's a growing sector in our economy.
Mm-hmm.
Many companies have these warehouses, and they're staffed by temp agencies. And what folks were finding was that there'd be this agency that would send Latinos out to certain sites, but no black folks. That was another campaign people got engaged in, to make sure that the temp agencies actually served all people who need a job, not just a certain segment of that.
Wow. Yeah, for sure.
One thing I want to mention, Jamal, as well, is important, that if you think about the kind of the I call it the work site dimension of the problem, it's super important. I think that black worker centers can play an important role in the nature of black policies themselves. Because an important issue clearly is how we see urban development, redevelopment take place. And the challenge is sometimes who leads that. And what happens oftentimes is that we'll have black elected officials who basically line up with traditional elites
mm-hmm.
in a city.
Mm-hmm.
And they can shape development plans that don't serve black folks well, to be honest.
Mm-hmm.
And so to think they actually get, you know, black workers basically being coming to the forefront, we can begin to talk about how do you cut deals that are actually better serve black folks, not just serve the real estate elites and those folks. And so it's a way of kind of bringing the issue of class and to the economy into the black debate, black political debate that's really needed.
Yeah, you talked about the formerly incarcerated. Last week, my guest was Sandra Keeley, and she is launching this expungement program. So to your point about, you know, folks coming out and can't find jobs, and what I think what the state has done is basically made it impossible for them to find or keep a job because they have stripped them of their right to college, you know, grants and loans. They can't get public housing. They can't, I mean, it's just like a laundry list of things that they can't do. And these are support, you know, mechanisms that would help them on their way. So having a job is very key to that. And so, you know, we'll be, you know, talking about that more, but I think a lot of folks just feel like once I've been there, you know, in prison, then that's it. And a lot of them don't even know about expungement, and neither do they know about being able to vote. So I just think we just need to up our education around that so that, you know, people in the community know that even if they don't have the right, we still are supposed to struggle in their behalf and advocate for them so that they get all of they need because they've already done their time. They've done their, you know, so-called sentence to society, and to keep on punishing them infinitum does not make good sense. It doesn't even make good financial sense, economic sense. So, yeah, that's a big one there. You mentioned sort of this gig economy, and I'm thinking, you know, for a lot of our younger folks who don't want to be on anybody's job, they, you know, this whole entrepreneurial spirit, but they get into these gig jobs thinking one thing and they're quite another. You know, and I'm just, you mentioned going to, you know, places like UPS or whatever, and, but, you know, even someplace like the Lyfts and the Ubers, you know, they finding out that it's not all what it's cracked up to be. And so those folks have not been really organized in a way that other sectors have. Do you see anything on the horizon helping those folks out?
Well, I think you're seeing more and more organizing in those areas that people have not been organized in. It can be talk about gig workers and trying to organize people who are doing the Lyft stuff and the DoorDash and those things. If you think about it, a lot of those folks are also in Starbucks, right? And people are organizing there as well.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of folks that are being in Amazon warehouse, people are organizing there. And so you have really this whole kind of strata of the economy where people are churning through, you know, bad job A, bad job B, bad job C. You might call it Starbucks, you might call it, you know, you might call it warehouse, you might call it some sort of, you know, lift type thing. There are a lot of commonalities there. And we see in each of those areas, we see some increase in organizing taking place. You know, one important thing too, You know, because of kind of, I call it the 50-year beatdown economically, the whole idea of a good job is kind of foreign to a lot of folks.
Mm.
You know, we joke about me being the old retiree, you know, both because of my age, meaning how I plug into the economy and the job I have, I got a pension. It's not, you know, a 401k, it's actually a pension that every month a check pops in, right? And that kind of notion is foreign to people.
Mm.
And so what makes those gig jobs attractive initially is part of people's view of hustle. I'm trying to get a hustle going on.
Mm-hmm.
And the challenge is how to see that there could be a world beyond the hustle. How those jobs that may be, you know, a Lyft job or a job at a Starbucks or a job in a warehouse can be made into a good job. Because back in the day, before you and I were born, Jamal, you know, a lot of those manufacturing jobs were shitty jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And they were made good jobs because union organizing. It's the same sort of notion that the struggle, jobs that are bad, we made better, is true today too, whether it be DoorDash, or be at Starbucks, or be at Amazon.
You know, I'm thinking about the hustle that you talk about, and you know, I was reading something that said a lot of the gig jobs disproportionately do affect black workers. But I'm thinking about, for example, this notion of job security beyond beyond the pay rate. But then there, you know, I have people coming to me that have done DoorDash or whatever and said, man, you know, you don't make no money. I work for this many hours and I only got this much money. So obviously even the direct, you know, hourly pay or whatever is not cracked up what it needs to be. But if you're going to work and you still can't make ends meet, and then there's nothing being put away for retirement or when you get old or when you get disabled, I don't know what kind of economy we're going to have in the future, given the gig economy, given the fact that a lot of these workers are part-time and if in some ways exposed to a lot of negative both sort of trauma on the job, but definitely exposing them to environmental hazards and that kind of thing, where they're going to need medical, you know, support and medical treatment later on, but they're not going to have the ability to pay for it. So I think when you look at the gig jobs and the hustle as opposed to a full-time job with all the benefits, I think that's where we want to go, right?
We want to get better jobs. And one thing also, Jamala, in my mind, there's a link between kind of the deterioration in job quality in the labor market, you know, a lot of bad jobs, no benefits, and so forth, and our very fraught current political situation. And I think back to the whole Raising the Sun, the poem, right? When the dream deferred, mm-hmm. and does it explode? That when you think about, really, since the mid-70s, an increase in inequality, I call it increase in the beatdown. That means there's been a lot of dreams been deferred. And the question was, what happens, right? Does it explode? So I think what you see now is with the explosion of deferred dreams. And I think the explosion is clearly racialized because the way that people experience the beatdown is racialized. But also the different responses to the beatdown. Some folks can get more engaged politically, I'll say on the good side. Some people can get more, can kind of drop out and kind of simply, you know, don't worry about politics at all. And some people get sucked into some right-wing bullshit, basically, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think the link between the complicated folks we face and the trauma in the labor market as well.
Mm. If you're just joining us, Voices from the Battlefield, this is Jamala, your host, Jamala Rogers, and we are talking with Stephen Pitts, who formerly was with the Labor Center. And did you actually start the Labor Center, or did you come there and just made it better?
I came there.
Okay, it was already there. But, you know, that's the thing, because sometimes on these campuses, stuff has been there for a while, and folks don't even know it. There's no relationship to the community. I just thought that you were the one who started it and made it and pop it and made it happen.
Well, if I start lying, I'll say that. But to tell the truth, it wasn't me, right?
Okay.
Being serious, Mal, a quick little short history. The labor centers, both up at in Berkeley, UC Berkeley, where I am, off down UCLA and down SoCal,
mm-hmm.
they started really as a large institute coming out of World War II. So the question was what to do with all the issues around come out of depression and those sort of things. And then in the mid-60s, they started out the labor centers to be an explicit outreach arm between the campus and the community itself. And that was kind of our mission.
Mm-hmm.
Things got kind of weak, but there's a big increase in funding in around 2000. That's why I came out. And it happened because of labor market power. Because the unions were so powerful, they said that basically, we need this. There's a surplus in the budget. This will take place. Just an example. You mentioned how Lola was doing a good work in terms of getting money back to the workers in L.A. The same thing happened back in 2000.
Mm.
But because of political power, we had the capacity to expand our work, basically.
Right.
And I came out in 2001.
Okay. But there is a needed link between a labor center and the community, even the labor movement, because I remember some of the reports that you all generated, and I think they were very helpful in informing our organizing. And so I don't really see that as much anymore. And so my hope is that the labor centers will stay in place and that they will be infused with new leadership who understands the sort of symbiotic relationship between community organizing struggles and their academic labor, you know, studies. So, yeah, it's just a lot of hope for that. But I want to turn our attention to what's been happening in organized labor for the last couple of years, and we've seen this amazing uptick in, you know, union organizing, and I've just been totally giddy about it because we've just been in this malaise for a while about nothing happening. And then all of a sudden, you know, the workers are, you know, self-organizing at places that folks never thought would be organized, at the Starbucks, at the UPS, you know. And so now, just recently, we had the union contract be signed in Tennessee for the Volkswagen plant. And that, I think that's sort of the icing on the cake, because is that not the last UAW stronghold? Do you know? I thought somebody, I read that somebody said now UAW is in all of the auto worker plants, and that was the last holdout.
Well, I would describe it being the South being the last hold, being the holdout. Because what you had is starting in really the 70s, you saw the plants were leaving kind of the Midwest and heading down South because they were non-union, low wages.
Mm-hmm.
You also saw some of the foreign companies, when they came to America, they didn't come to Detroit, they went to Tennessee, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so you had this kind of growing auto sector in the South that was unorganized. And the great news is that the new leadership of the UAW, United Auto Workers, has said, we're going to conquer these folk. And they picked up the mantle and picked up the steam. And after they had this very successful contract battle with the big three, they turned their sights down South and said, we're going to take care of the South. And so they did the blitz of many, many factories. As you said, they got the positive vote in Chattanooga. Looking at this Mercedes plant in Alabama, looking at
mm-hmm,
that.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're on the move, which is a phenomenal thing, because mm-hmm. oftentimes success brings success.
Right.
And
right.
So when folks see that, wow, they had a good country battle, maybe leading that. And also the next day say, wow, they won in Chattanooga. We're next, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so you really get a positive kind of spiller effect that I'm excited to see.
Yeah, that was amazing. And I'm almost sure that the Mercedes plant is going to be able to declare victory as well, because the momentum is behind them right now. What do you think is causing the momentum? I mean, we've had bad working conditions. We've had low wages for a while. What do you think was the impetus for sort of pumping up or reviving, the labor movement?
I think there are maybe three factors. You mentioned one, that the jobs are bad, right? You have kind of the basic conditions are ripe for something. I think also in the case of a lot of the efforts in Chattanooga, this was the third bite of the apple. They had tried two other times and lost.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it means that you had a period of struggle. It wasn't simply folks got up on Monday, we're going to organize by Wednesday, right?
Yeah.
You had a decade of serious work going on,
mm-hmm.
and we see the fruits of that long period of organizing. And thirdly, you had new leadership, that for the first time in the UAW, you had a member-driven vote for president. Before, the president had been elected at a convention, and this was different. Mm. You had kind of a reform movement inside the OAW, and they won the election, and Sean Fain, who's been the president, is clearly on the side of organizing. And so I think leadership matters. And so it's both the conditions themselves, one factor, is the sustained period of organizing, the second factor, and third is the idea of having good leadership as well.
Well, I definitely agree with that. I'm thinking about the leadership part. And I think it's been the poor leadership on the part of unions that have really repelled black workers from either joining or participating. So I often hear from, like, well, they're not doing anything for me. Well, in fact, they are, but you could be helping to make those decisions if you're at the meetings and if you holding the feet to the fire. Cause we've had, far as I'm concerned, Steve, far too many union leadership being indicted and going off to jail. I mean, that doesn't serve the working class at all. So, you know, if they don't have members around them that are holding their feet to the fire, I think they can slip into that kind of bribery and that kind of corruption.
Mm-hmm. I think actually the previous, well, so the brother who was president before Fain, he wasn't indicted, but the two before then were indicted at UAW. But I want to separate kind of getting involved in the union from joining a union for a second, okay?
Okay.
So I think that in terms of being involved with what you said, that people have these kind of bureaucratic practices, you know, serve people well, people say, I gotta raise my kid, I'm out of it, right? So I think you're right in terms of how leadership has in the past kind of stifled participation. But in terms of joining a union, organizing a union, the main problem is simply the tax from management. Where, you know, you talk union, you get fired. Mm-hmm. You know, and the way they enforce the law, I can fire you illegally, what you gonna do about it?
Mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm.
And you can take me to court and 3 years later on what's going on. So I think in terms of actually joining while co-organizing a union, the main thing holding that back is simply management tax on unionization itself. But in terms of the idea of having a vibrant democratic union, that's on us. Mm-hmm. And us meaning bad leadership, and we need to be more aggressive to make it more democratic, more vibrant.
Mm-hmm. And let me just make a correction. I wasn't necessarily talking about the UAW being indicted, going to jail. I'm talking about unions, period, where we've seen that over the last, you know, 20 years of folks, you know, not using union dues well and using it for themselves and friends and family. And so I'm just saying that does put a thing in your mind about, well, what is the union and what are they doing? They're not doing much with our money. But I agree that the opposition to it at the point where people are in the plant trying to organize or at the workplace trying to organize, that there's a lot hostility for sure. And sometimes it's not always by the management. Sometimes other workers are saying, you're going to make it bad for us and we're all going to get fired and then nobody will have a job. And so, you know, it's a lot of education that has to go on. And you talked about it in Chattanooga at the Volkswagen plant. You know, they had a election in 2014 and 2019 and lost. And so, but they didn't give up. And I think that to me is what has to happen. You cannot give up. You may need to change tactics. You might need to retreat and figure it out. But you can't give up because that's a big plant. I mean, the Volkswagen plant down there is nothing to be sneezed at. And so, for me, just seeing those workers hang in there and keep coming back in the third time was a charm.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah. So where else do you see, you know, some, worker struggle highlights that, you know, we need to be watching or supporting? Any industry that's, you know, that's getting ready to make some big moves?
Well, I think we need, one thing to keep in mind is looking at what's happening in education with teachers and in healthcare. Because both those sort of sectors can't be farmed out, right? You can't take a public school in LA and ship it to Miami, okay? So this kind of stuck there. You can't take a ER in Chicago and send it down to New Orleans. And so that kind of rootedness gives workers more kind of power and more leverage. And we've seen, I mean, we may have forgotten about the whole Red for Ed thing that was very big for five, 6 years ago, is still vibrant. And so in Chicago, look at the teachers union in Chicago, they were instrumental in electing one of their own mayor of Chicago, right? In LA, with the United Teachers of LA, that teachers union was very strong and doing very positive things. And I think one thing to look at is how teachers are being organized to kind of improve conditions in the school, but also improve the conditions of students as well. Health is the same sort of thing. And fighting for better conditions, meaning lower nurse to patients to ratios, those sort of things. So that's one thing I would look at, kind of look at teachers and healthcare. Mm. And then as you mentioned, we see kind of bubbling in kind of the, when we say Starbucks, that's clearly one thing to look at, but it's all this kind of low wage, high turnover situations, right? So we see it in Starbucks, and they're actually negotiating with Starbucks now so to get a contract. You know, we see some bubblings happening at Amazon, different places beyond the victory that took place on Staten Island several years ago. You know, down in the South, they're doing the whole, I've got the name of it, but SEIU is involved in terms of trying to get some of the Dollar General stores involved, mm-hmm. and get them organized mm-hmm. as well.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so we see kind of bubblings of stuff. It's important to remember, though, that it took 10 years to get Chattanooga, right? And so these things aren't going to, you know, overnight mm-hmm. grow up into a massive thing. It takes time, it takes struggle, and it takes persistence.
Yeah. You know, I'm thinking about talking about places that need to be organized. A worker yesterday, young sister, got fired from Walmart, and somebody captured her just going through the store, knocking down, you know, whole counters, and very, very angry. And I'm thinking, you know, Walmart helps to create those kinds of conditions for folks mm-hmm. to want to go off. And, you know, my hope is that, that somebody was able to say, and I actually heard somebody, it might have been the person doing the filming, sister, it's not worth going to jail. But to me, it points to some other thing. We want to look at her and say, what was her problem? What's she doing? But what led her to that? And I just, you know, right. it seems like Walmart right. gets off the hook when it comes to, reorganizing just because they're, you know, making so much money and hiring all these people and then they claim to be doing good in the neighborhood that, you know, they don't seem to be the target, but they definitely have a bunch of workers working for them who need some help. They need some support.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I think there's two kind of issues that are important for workers in the job. One is kind of the traditional sort of wages and benefits, right? I get better money, I get some time, I get health care, right? But also it's kind of the daily insults people get too.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that what happens sometimes, because so wrapped up in the contract, we forget about the need to stop the daily mashdown that takes place, daily beating that takes place, give rise to the sister losing a job and going off on folk, right?
Mm-hmm.
I remember when I was in a factory back in Houston back in the 70s, a couple times folks get fired, they take out, they have their toolbox, they take out the hammer and go up inside a supervisor's head on the way out.
Mm.
You know? And it's just because people felt frustrated, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so it's important to find ways to channel frustration into some sort of organized effort to improve conditions. And it may not result in day one in the contract, but maybe they have the capacity to kind of keep someone's job there, or maybe get rid of that supervisor, get better scheduling, those sort of things.
Right. Yeah, because I think there might be unorganized workplaces where people still need some relief. They need even some suggestions about how to cope with some of the injustices, and I don't know that exists to the point that people readily know, oh, I can go there or I can go here and they'll give me some support. And it's not necessarily organizing a union, but it's, you know, what you do until a union comes in. And so, meanwhile, that's why you have that turnstile. It's like folks can't cope and then they just go to another job and then the same thing happens there. And it's just like a never ending, cycle of that kind of thing. I also want to talk to you, Steve, about, I think one of the, places that the workers center did well, I'm talking about the labor center, is really just going beyond worker struggle, but really talking about immigration rights, gender equity, environmental justice, food justice, because all of these affect workers. And I'm thinking now about the influx of immigrants in places and cities where we had not seen them before, and how the state and also employers are pitting, you know, folks against each other. What, how should we be looking at that landscape, and who should be the one trying to negotiate how we work together with folks who we don't know that's coming from other places, and the perception is they're making it hard for us?
Mm-hmm. I think that's important to, if lack of a better term, you have two sides of the fence. You have immigrants coming here for a better life. You have our folk here trying to get a better life as well, right? I think you need to organize on both sides of that fence, basically, you know? And people get a sense of seeing the common conditions, and the problem is not that I took your job, or I want your job, or I'm more hard on you, that kind of stuff. More that there's some conditions that beat down all of us. That's an important perspective that needs to be put forth. But it takes place through actually organizing, which means having the conversations, building relationships, you know, forming organizations, building campaigns. So instead of fighting somebody who just got here, we fight someone who's making serious money off of both our backs, basically.
Mm-hmm. No, that's real, because we always look at the low-hanging fruit or who's in front of us instead of looking at who's behind the curtain. So, yeah, yeah. You know, is there the way that the job market is going, and the landscape for jobs, you know, it's more housekeeping, it's you know, low wage jobs. What is going to be the challenge going forward to getting fair and better wages and better working conditions when, you know, that's the wave of the future, and a lot of the unions aren't necessarily tapping into some of those sectors yet? What is it that those workers can be doing to get some relief for themselves until they can organize a union?
Well, that's the point of like non-union forms of organizations, like workers' centers, right? Well, you can think about it. You could also have, say, a major church in a community that has a lot of its congregants who are in those same jobs. They could have a labor ministry, right? Do the same sort of thing that talks about, one, about people's rights that they have. I remember when I was going to a Chevron gas station in Oakland a couple years ago, and I was going to wait in line, pay my money, so I get some candy, whatever else, right? And the sister was saying to a fellow worker, "My check is funny." That's called wage theft, right?
Mm-hmm.
But what happens is that we're talking about ourselves about our check is funny. And what would happen if you had a church saying, "I want you to know a lot of our people in the pews, and maybe your nieces and nephews may have some jobs that, you know, 7-Eleven or where else. They have certain rights about wages and so forth." You could actually have that being a vehicle to talk about and organize around worker rights where the union is not present itself. I think beyond that kind of organizing, what you also see more and more is an attempt to have, you know, laws and ordinances passed at the local level around scheduling issues, around issues around you gotta have some sort of health care, put money into a health care fund, you gotta, you know, provide higher wages beyond minimum wage. And so to the extent that we see paralysis, is a nice term, in Washington D.C. around stuff, you could have at a local level attempts to use the public policy to improve people's conditions as well.
Yeah, I'm just thinking about what you said and thinking about when we're telling young people who coming out of school where to go, and they looking at, you know, higher education, and they're like, "I don't want to go into all that debt, plus I may not have the skills to do that." But, you know, in terms of the trade schools, it seems to be a lot of for-profit entities, when before those were part of the public school system. Yeah. Like when you and I were going to school, you could learn welding, you could learn auto mechanics right there inside of the school. And those have pretty much been wiped out. So then these young people have to get these loans, to go to these for-profit schools, and then they don't guarantee placement like you would if you were an apprentice in a union and then you go straight to a good paying job. What are we to do with these sort of for-profit places that are just ripping poor folks off who think they're getting ready to get that little certificate and go somewhere?
Well, if I ran the world, it'd be illegal, right?
My world, too.
I don't run the world. But I think that gets back to, I think, I mentioned before, some of the internal black politics going on. Because the problem is that you have a need, right? Where you have a need for training, folk got to be trained. You have a vacuum in terms of lack of, you know, public involvement in taking care of that need. And so people pop up. Some people legitimate. Some people are crooks, right? And what happens then is all of a sudden you have folk who may or may not have our interest in heart, who look like us, saying we need these kind of for-profit things in order to help our community. That's why I think it's important to talk about actual organizing from below and not relying on kind of middlemen or spokespersons who say they speak for us, but without any actual community, you know, serious clout. They may either themselves not have good intentions or get swayed by other actors who got some money to throw around. And so I think that, one, you need to organize against these private, these for-profit entities, right? Mm-hmm. You need to wipe out the debt, basically. Mm-hmm. But more important, you need to develop the concrete public pipelines from school to these jobs or, you know, community to these jobs. Make it concrete. You know, it can't just be, well, here's some training, here's a piece of paper, and good luck, right?
Mm-hmm.
It got to be that you get you the program, you stay with it, outside of the school, you walk into a job. Can't be a good luck type of situation. But also it's important, Jamal, to recognize that what we're speaking about really is sector by sector strategies. It's usually raised the question of the trades, right? This says of construction, what's the strategy? That it needs to be clear and concrete, different from a strategy in schools, different from a strategy in healthcare, strategy in Walmart. And so a lot of times what happens in these conversations, and I don't think we're doing it, but sometimes beyond us, right? So we'll say that this one thing will solve all of our problems. It's not going to happen. You got to take every sector and be concrete and find out how you organize workers and how you have concrete policy to improve job situation.
But, you know, that whole thing about making these folks illegal, I really think that's something to be considered because they are definitely predators. You got young people hungry for a career, hungry for, you know, trying to get a job where they can take care of themselves and their family. And here comes somebody that says, hey, I can give you a guaranteed loan. Well, sometimes folks finish and sometimes they don't, and then they defaulted on the loan. So, you know, 2, 3, 4, or 5 years later, somebody else comes with the same game and they do the same thing. So now they have like, you know, $25,000 worth of debt that that's preventing them from getting a car, a house, or whatever. So it's just, you know, repercussions that just reverberate through these young people's lives. And when they come to me and they say, I got 3 certificates and I owe this many thousands of dollars and I still don't have a job, you know, I just get so angry about these folks. But they don't really care. There's just like an assembly line. Let's get them in, sign them up, and if they continue, fine. If they don't, still fine. But we got our money, and, you know, and that's the end of that. But I think they ought to be illegal. That's what I think.
Well, yeah. But going back to the world that we don't control things, right? The value of kind of wiping out student debt is it cuts off the money.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you wipe out student debt, somebody's left holding the bag, right?
Mm-hmm.
And at some point, it's going to go down. If someone's fearful of not being paid back, they won't issue the loan. And the loan is the lifeblood of these credit organizations. They won't gain any lifeblood, right? And so I think that a strategy to control them is actually wipe out the debt itself. Because if they can't get students to get loans, they can't survive. So I think the idea of wiping out student debt is important. To the extent that there is sort of public monies tied to these organizations, have concrete sort of guidelines. You must have perform a certain way in terms of placements, those sort of things. There's ways to try to maybe use public policy to actually constrain the behavior or squeeze them out, basically.
So you raise a good point about the debt, the student debt, but are those for-profits, are they included in what the president is talking about?
I don't think so. Because
I don't either.
But that's because of that's the mess in D.C., right? and I'm being nice today because Mayday, right?
Yeah.
you know, he couldn't get something through Congress because of Congress, right?
Mm-hmm.
So he took some second steps that had a limited scope. It's very important, by the way, but it's limited. And the issue is, how do you get, this is clearly a much longer, broader conversation, is how do you get a better line of political forces in D.C. to get better policy? You know, and it's a super complicated battle, Jamal, as you know. I mean, I don't know Missouri well. I know St. Louis a little bit. I know Kansas City less. Beyond that, that's it, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I think I know Texas fairly well. I know California fairly well. And we forget in those states that at some point in time, we didn't go outside the urban areas to kind of build power. You can't just lock down, you know, the Bay and L.A., expect to, you know, do a lot of things because there are parts of the state that aren't progressive as folk might be in the Bay and L.A. And in Texas, same thing, that you have kind of blue cities in Houston and Dallas and Fort Worth and so forth. But outside the areas, they're locked down red, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's important to talk about how do you both solidify our power where we exist, but also how do we expand power where we don't exist? What does that actually mean in the real world? Right? So what may be useful in Oakland or St. Louis might not roll in other parts of the states, right?
Yeah, because we are at will state. Even if, you know, these folks tell you they want to fire you, they don't have to give you a reason. And we fought off for like years this being a right to work state. So if that ever got into place, that plus, you know, the at will work, we, you know, I think people would be fired left and right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah. Well, wow. I just, you know, when I look at, you know, policies around labor, I look at, you know, what's going on with the administration. What do you see as a policy issue that we need to be focusing in on? Either a bad one or a good one, one that we need to pull or one that we need to get in place.
Well, bad ones, how much time do you got, girl? But I think the also important question level of government. To be honest, I think that in terms of D.C., that we should simply, like, not worry about it. It's a total mess in D.C. Nothing good. And I don't mean ignore it all together. I mean in terms of being a place where in Congress you get sincerely good thing coming out, that's not going to happen, okay? We can talk about kind of forestalling some of the things toward authoritarianism going on, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But I think in terms of really, really great public policy, you won't come out of D.C. We can have some good administrative things, and so Biden has put some good people on the National Labor Relations Board. It's very important, you know? He has a really good woman who was acting Secretary of Labor. They won't make her full time because she's too good, by the way. She's still acting.
Mm-hmm.
So there's some things to be done administratively right now because Biden's president, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of legislation, anything that I call really good won't happen. So the question is what can happen at a state level or a city or county level, right? And you have people talking about having, you know, higher minimum wages in a city. You know, in California, they call this sectoral bargaining in fast food. So they have set up a fast food council where you have this kind of council made up of workers and fast food businesses and third parties to discuss certain conditions of work, wages, and so forth. And so the issue is simply what can you do at the local state level that can improve folks' capacity to live and work?
Well, when I'm thinking about at the state level, a lot of these states are red or purple, about to turn red, and I'm just wondering what are the openings there. But you know, I think sometimes when if we frame the thing for workers, we have a better chance than if we say black workers, unfortunately, because they, you know, some of these Republicans think that anything they do for black people or brown people is a no-no. But, you know, what about these states that, you know, are, some of them have, you know, they're triple threats because the governor, the state, both houses are controlled. Or sometimes we got a Democratic governor, but, you know, they have veto power, but sometimes they don't have a veto-proof, you know, situation. And so, you know, you want to let potential voters or voters know, like, who to vote for, where to vote for. But in this particular scenario, it seems like these folks got it locked down pretty good.
Except, Jamala, you know, in your situation in Missouri, folk beat back that right to work thing, right?
Yep.
And so in Florida, they passed their reenfranchisement for former incarcerated people. Mm-hmm. And a lot of southern states that they increased minimum wages and so forth. And so I think that there's probably, two different pathways that we got to work on. One is how do you have those kind of statewide referenda that can have, you know, policy impacts? Because when we get to the people, it's easy to organize something versus some sort of intrinsic person in who's a representative or a state senator sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But also, I think you got to figure out how to get to people in places we aren't normally at. That's a lot of hard work that the old retiree can't do, by the way. But it's getting out the cities and going to the other areas where people are who, I mean, some people are lost causes, okay? That is
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But some people aren't, though. They just get, they go where they're going, right?
Right.
And to the extent we know people might vote, do have voted for against right to work. People have voted to reenfranchise former incarcerated. You know people are good folk out there. You got the votes. Just gotta get them, you know?
And I think you're absolutely right. Every time we've done polling around minimum wage, you know, overwhelmingly, you know, it's, you know, transcends race. And so we've been able to get some wins there, both at the state level and at the local level. In fact, we have a petition, a ballot initiative going on now that, lots of, petitions have been signed and ready to be turned in to not only, raise the minimum wage, but also to include, paid leave. And so, you know, we'll see what that does when it gets on the ballot, but I'm hopeful. Yeah.
Another example is this is kind of across the border from you, but over in Kansas City, Kansas, right, where they were trying to. But Missouri, where are the Chiefs?
Chiefs are Kansas City, Missouri.
Okay, I'm sorry, Missouri, right? Mm-hmm. They voted down that the idea that doing that bond thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Won a Super Bowl, so they'd be still getting no money, right?
Right.
And so you have the potential there. It's a good guy. We got to do the work. You know, keep doing the work.
Mm-hmm.
No magic bullet. Just keep doing the work.
Right. So, you know, doing the work is what we must do. Steve Pitts, I want to thank you for joining us today and talking about worker struggle on International Workers' Day, May 1st, May Day.
Yeah. Well, one last thing, Jamal. I'm glad to do this, but an old friend of mine, old mentor of mine, you know, Tim Thomas.
Oh, yeah.
And what Tim said always was, Kazi was the blackest of all.
Mm-hmm.
Which means you got to work. Got to put the work in, girl.
Yeah.
You got to put the work in.
You got to put the work in. That's going to determine how good you are, how great you think you are. But it's all about Kazi, and that's why he word for work. So, yeah, that's what's ahead of us, particularly given this election cycle. We're going to have to do a lot of work. We don't have be smart about the way that we organize. So next week, we're going to have Jamal Burton Village on. They are doing phenomenal work in with doulas and midwives. And given the way that our health care industry is going, we're going to need some supplemental folks who can help us with some of these medical conditions. But Jamal will be on here next week. And we you know, if you've missed a session or you missed a show and you want to go back to that, just go and visit JamalaRogers.com, and you can see that. And we've got some good stuff coming up. We're going to be celebrating African Liberation Day. We're talking about Brown versus the Board of Education. And then we're going to be talking about Pruitt-Igoe, the failed housing experiment that St. Louis will never shake itself from. So, again, thank you for joining us. This is Jamala, your host. I'll see you on the battlefield.
We've got to do the right thing. We've got to do it.